and because the family fortune had always been their safety net. The last strong with any vision had evidently seen the end, and established trusts for education, thick trusts written by squads of lawyers, impenetrable trusts clad with iron and able to withstand the desperate assaults from future strongs. The assaults came, the trusts held firm, and any young strong was still guaranteed a fine education. Cody boarded at Taft, was an average student at Dartmouth, then received an MBA from Columbia. His marriage to Gina Phelan had not been well received by the family, primarily because it was her second. The fact that her estranged father was worth, at the time of the wedding, $6 billion helped ease her entry into the clan. But she would always be looked down on because she was a divorcee and poorly educated at non-Ivy League schools, and also because Cody was a bit odd. But they were all there to greet her on Christmas Day. She had never seen so many smiles from people she detested, so many stiff little hugs and awkward pecks on the cheeks and pats on the shoulder. She hated them even more for their phoniness. A couple of drinks, and Cody began talking. The men grouped around him in the den, and it wasn't long before someone asked how much. He frowned, as if the money was already a burden. "Probably $500 million, he said, the perfect delivery of a line he'd rehearsed in front of his bathroom mirror. Some of the men gasped. Others grimaced, because they knew Cody, and they were all strongs, and they knew they would never see a dime of it. They all quietly seethed with envy. Word filtered out from the group, and before long the women scattered around the house were whispering about the $500 million. Cody's mother, a prim and shriveled little woman, whose wrinkles cracked when she smiled, was appalled by the obscenity of the fortune. "It's new money," she said to a daughter. "New money, earned by a scandalous old goat with three wives and a string of bad children, not a one of whom attended an Ivy League school." New or old, the money was much envied by the younger women. They could see the jets and beach houses and fabulous family gatherings on distant islands, and trust funds for nieces and nephews, and perhaps even outright gifts of cash. The money thawed the Strongs, thawed them to a warmness they had never shown to an outsider, thawed them to the point of melting. It taught them openness and love, and made for a warm, cozy Christmas. Late in the afternoon, as the family gathered around the table for the traditional dinner, it began to snow. "What a perfect Christmas," all the Strongs said. Gina hated them more than ever. Ramble spent the holiday with his lawyer at $600 an hour, though the billing would be hidden, as only lawyers can hide such things. Tyra, likewise, had left the country with a young gigolo. She was on a beach somewhere, topless and probably bottomless, too, and completely unconcerned with what her 14-year-old son might be doing. The lawyer, Yancey, was single, twice divorced, and had twin 11-year-old sons from his second marriage. The boys were exceptionally bright for their age. Ramble was painfully slow for his, so they had a great time playing video games in the bedroom while Yancey watched football alone. His client was set to receive the obligatory $5 million on his 21st birthday, and given the client's level of maturity and direction at home, the money wouldn't last even as long as it had for the other Phelan offspring. But Yancey wasn't concerned with a meager $5 million. Hell, he'd make that much in fees off Ramble's cut from the will. Yancey had other worries. Tyra had hired a new law firm, an aggressive one near the capital, one with all the right connections. She was only an ex-wife, not an offspring, and her portion would be much smaller than anything Ramble received. The new lawyers, of course, realized this. They were pressuring Tyra to ditch Yancey and steer young Ramble into their corner. Fortunately, the mother didn't care much for the child, and Yancey was doing a splendid job of manipulating child away from mother. The laughter of the boys was music to his ears. Chapter 16. He stopped at a small deli a few blocks from the hotel. Late in the afternoon, he was roaming the sidewalks, saw that the deli was open, and walked into it with the hope of finding a beer. Nothing but a beer. Maybe two. He was alone, on the far side of the world. It was Christmas, and he had no one to share it with. A wave of loneliness and depression fell hard upon Nate, and he began to slide. Self-pity seized him. He saw the rows of bottles of liquor, all full and unopened, whiskies and gins and vodkas, lined up like pretty little soldiers in bright uniforms. His mouth was instantly dry, even parched. His jaw dropped, and his eyes closed. He grabbed the counter so he wouldn't waver, and his entire face contorted with pain as he thought about Sergio back at Walnut Hill, and Josh, and the ex-wives, and the ones he'd hurt so many times when he crashed. Thoughts spun wildly, and he was about to faint when the little man said something. Nate glowered at him, bit his lip, and pointed at the vodka. Two bottles, 8 reais. Every crash had been different. Some were slow in building, a drink here, a snort there, a crack in the dam, followed by more. Once he'd actually driven himself to a detox center. Another time he'd awakened strapped to a bed with an IV in his wrist. With the last crash, a maid had found him in a cheap motel room, $30 a day, in the bathtub, comatose. He clutched the paper sack and walked with a purpose to his hotel, stepping around a group of sweaty little boys dribbling a soccer ball on the sidewalk. So lucky are the children, he thought. No burdens, no baggage. Tomorrow's just another game. It would be dark in an hour, and Corumbá was gently coming to life. The sidewalk cafes and bars were opening, a few cars moved about. At the hotel, live music from the pool drifted through the lobby, and for a second Nate was tempted to get a table for one last song. But he didn't. He went to his room, where he locked the door and filled a tall plastic cup with ice. He placed the bottle side by side, opened one, slowly poured the vodka over the ice, and vowed not to stop until both were empty. Chevy was waiting for the parts merchant when he finally arrived at 8. The sun was up and unfiltered by clouds. The sidewalks were hot to the touch. There was no oil pump, at least not one for a diesel engine. The merchant made 2 calls, and Chevy roared away in his pickup. He drove to the edge of Corumbá, where a boat dealer ran a salvage yard cluttered with the remains of dozens of scrapped vessels. In the engine shop, a parts boy produced a well-used oil pump, covered with oil and grease, and wrapped in a dirty shop rag. Chevy gladly paid 20 reais for it. He drove to the river and parked near the water's edge. The Santa Laura hadn't moved. He was pleased to see that Welly had arrived. Welly was a novice deckhand, not yet 18, who claimed he could cook, pilot, guide, clean, navigate, and perform any and all other services required. Chevy knew he was lying, but such bravado was not uncommon among boys looking for work on the river. "Have you seen Mr. O'Reilly?" Chevy asked. "The American?" asked Welly. "Yes, the American." "No, no sign of him." A fisherman in a wooden boat yelled something at Chevy, but he was preoccupied with other matters. He bounced across the plywood onto the boat where the banging had started again in the rear. The same grimy mechanic was wrestling with the engine. He hovered over it in a half-crouch, shirtless and dripping with sweat. The engine room was suffocating. Chevy handed him the oil pump, and he inspected it with his short, stubby fingers. The engine was a 5-cylinder inline diesel, with the pump at the bottom of the crankcase, just below the edge of the grated floor. The mechanic shrugged, as if Chevy's purchase might indeed do the trick. Then he maneuvered his belly around the manifold and dropped slowly to his knees and bent low with the top of his head resting on the exhaust. He grunted something, and Chevy handed him a wrench. The replacement pump was slowly fitted into place. Chevy's shirt and shorts were soaked within minutes. With both men wedged tightly into the engine room, Welly decided to appear and ask if he was needed. No, in fact, he was not. "Just watch for the American," Chevy said, wiping sweat from his forehead. The mechanic cursed and flung wrenches for half an hour, then declared the pump ready for use. He started the engine and spent a few minutes monitoring the oil pressure. He finally smiled, then gathered his tools. Chevy drove downtown to the hotel to find Nate. The shy girl at the front desk had not seen Mr. O'Reilly. She phoned his room, and no one answered. A maid walked by the desk and got herself quizzed. No, to her knowledge, he had not left the room. Reluctantly, the girl gave Chevy a key. The door was locked, but unchained, and Chevy entered slowly. The first odd thing he noticed was the empty bed with its disheveled sheets. Then he saw the bottles. One was empty and lying on its side on the floor. The other was half-filled. The room was very cool, the air conditioner running at full speed. He saw a bare foot, then stepped closer to see Nate, lying naked, wedged between the bed and the wall with a sheet pulled down and wrapped around his knees. Chevy gently kicked his foot, and the leg jerked. At least he wasn't dead. Chevy spoke to him and jabbed his shoulder, and after a few seconds a grunt was heard. A low, painful emission. Squatting on the bed, Chevy carefully clasped his hands under the nearest armpit and pulled Nate up from the floor, away from the wall, and managed to roll him onto the bed, where he quickly covered his privates with a sheet. Another painful groan. Nate was on his back, with one foot hanging off the bed, eyes swollen and still closed, hair wild, his breathing slow and labored. Chevy stood at the end of the bed and stared at him. The maid and the girl from the front desk appeared at the crack in the door, and Chevy waved them away. He locked it and picked up the empty bottle. "It's time to go," he said, and received no response whatsoever. Perhaps he should call Valdir, who in turn would report to the Americans who'd sent this poor drunk to Brazil. Maybe later. "Nate," he said loudly, "speak to me." No response. If he didn't rally soon, Chevy would call a doctor. A bottle and a half of vodka in one night could kill a man. Maybe his system was poisoned and he needed a hospital. In the bathroom, he soaked a towel with cold water, then wrapped it around Nate's neck. Nate began to squirm, and he opened his mouth in an effort to speak.
"Where am I?"
he grunted, his tongue thick and sticky.
"In Brazil, in your hotel room." "I'm alive."
"More or less." Chevy took an edge of the towel and wiped Nate's face and eyes.
"How do you feel?"
he asked.
"I want to die," Nate said, reaching for the towel.
He took it, eased it into his mouth, and began sucking on it.
"I'll get some water," Chevy said.
He opened the refrigerator and removed a bottle of water.
"Can you lift your head?"
he asked.
"No," Nate grunted.
Chevy dripped water onto Nate's lips and tongue. Some of it rolled down his cheeks and into the towel. He didn't care. His head was splitting and pounding, and his first thought was exactly how in hell did he wake up? An eye opened, the right one, barely. The lids on the left were still matted together. Light scalded his brain, and a wave of nausea rolled from his knees to his throat. With surprising suddenness, he flipped to one side, then rocked on all fours as the vomit shot forth. Chevy jumped back, then went for another towel. He lingered in the bathroom, listening to the gagging and coughing. The sight of a naked man on his hands and knees in the middle of a bed puking his guts out was something he could do without. He turned on the shower and adjusted the water. His deal with Valdir paid him 1,000 reais to take Mr. O'Reilly into the Pantanal, find the person he was searching for, then deliver him back to Corumbá. It was good money, but he wasn't a nurse, and he wasn't a babysitter. The boat was ready. If Nate couldn't answer the bell without an escort, then Jevy would move along to the next job. There was a break in the nausea, and Jevy manhandled Nate into the bathroom, into the shower, where he crumpled onto the plastic floor.
"I'm sorry," he said over and over.
Jevy left him there to drown for all he cared. He folded the sheets and tried to clean the mess. Then he went downstairs for a pot of strong coffee. It was almost 2 when Welly heard them coming. Jevy parked on the bank, his huge truck scattering rocks and waking fishermen as it roared to a stop. There was no sign of the American. Then a head slowly lifted itself from somewhere in the cab. The eyes were covered with thick shades, and a cap was pulled as low as possible. Jevy opened the passenger door and helped Mr. O'Reilly onto the rocks. Welly walked to the truck and grabbed Nate's bag and briefcase from the back. He wanted to meet Mr. O'Reilly, but the timing was bad. He was quite ill, with bleached skin that was soaked with sweat, and he was too weak to walk on his own. Welly followed them to the edge of the water and helped guide them along the rickety plywood walkway onto the boat. Jevy practically carried Mr. O'Reilly up the steps to the bridge, then along the catwalk to the small deck where the hammock was waiting. He shoveled him into it. When they returned to the deck, Jevy started the engine and Welly pulled the ropes.
"What's wrong with him?"
Welly asked.
"He's drunk." "But it's only 2 o'clock.
"He's been drunk for a long time." The Santa Laura eased away from the shore, and moving upriver, slowly made its way past Corumbá. Nate watched the city go by. The roof above him was a thick, worn, green canvas stretched over a metal frame anchored to the deck by 4 poles. 2 of these supported his hammock, which had rocked a bit just after the launch. The nausea crept back. He tried not to move. He wanted everything to be perfectly still. The boat moved gently upstream. The river was smooth. There was no wind at the moment, so Nate was able to lie deep in his hammock and stare at the dark green canvas above him and try to ponder things. The pondering was difficult, though, because his head spun and ached. Concentration was a challenge. He had called Josh from his room just before checking out. With ice packs on his neck and a wastebasket between his feet, he had dialed the number and tried mightily to sound normal. Jevy hadn't told Valdir. Valdir hadn't told Josh. No one knew but Nate and Jevy, and they had agreed to keep it that way. There was no alcohol on the boat, and Nate had promised sobriety until they returned. How was he supposed to find a drink in the Pantanal? If Josh was worried, his voice didn't convey it. The firm was still closed for Christmas, etc., but he was busy as hell. The usual. Nate said that he was doing just fine. The boat was adequate and now properly repaired. They were anxious to set sail. When he hung up, he vomited again. And then he showered again. Then Jevy helped him to the elevator and through the lobby. The river bent slightly and turned again, and Corumbá disappeared. The boat traffic around the city thinned as their journey gained momentum. Nate's vantage point gave him a view of the wake and of the muddy brown water bubbling behind them. The Paraguay was less than 100 yards wide and narrowed quickly around the bends. They passed a rickety boat laden with green bananas, and 2 small boys waved. The steady knock of the diesel failed to stop, as Nate had hoped, but it became a low hum, a constant vibration throughout the entire vessel. There was no choice but to accept it. He tried swinging in the hammock, a gentle swing as a breeze crept through. The nausea was gone. "Don't think about Christmas and home
and children, and broken memories. And don't think about your addictions. The crash is over, he told himself. The boat was his treatment center. Jevy was his counselor. Welly was his nurse. He'd dry out in the Pantanal, then never drink again. How many times could he lie to himself? The aspirin Jevy had given him wore off, and his head pounded again. He lapsed into a near sleep and awoke when Welly appeared with a bottle of water and a bowl of rice. He ate it with a spoon, his hand shaking so badly he spilled the rice on his shirt and in the hammock. It was warm and salty, and he ate every grain.
"Mice?" Welly asked.
Nate shook his head no, then sipped the water. He sank into the hammock and tried to nap. Chapter 17. After a few false starts, the jet lag and fatigue and the after-effects of the vodka caught up with him. The rice helped too, and Nate fell into a hard, deep sleep. Welly checked on him every hour. "He's snoring," he reported to Jevy in the wheelhouse. The sleep was dreamless. His nap lasted 4 hours as the Santa Laura inched ahead in the general direction of north, against the current and the wind. Nate awoke to the steady beat of the diesel and the sensation that the boat was not really moving. He rose gently in the hammock and peeked over the edge and studied the riverbank for signs of progress. The vegetation was dense. The river appeared completely uninhabited. There was a wake behind the boat, and by staring at a tree he could tell that, yes, they were in fact going somewhere, but very slowly. The water was up because of the rains. Navigation was easier, but traffic upstream was not as fast. The nausea and headaches were gone, but movements were still delicate. He began the challenge of removing himself from the hammock, primarily because he needed to urinate. He managed to safely place his feet on the deck without incident, and as he paused for a moment, Welly appeared like a mouse and handed him a small cup of coffee. Nate took the warm cup, cradled it, and sniffed it. Nothing had ever smelled better.
"Obrigado," he said.
"Thanks."
"Sing,"
Welly said, with an even brighter smile. Nate sipped the precious, sweet coffee and tried not to return Welly's stare. The kid was dressed in the standard river garb, old gym shorts, old T-shirt, and cheap rubber sandals that protected the soles of scarred and hardened feet. Like Jevy and Valdir and most of the Brazilians he'd met so far, Welly had black hair and dark eyes and semi-Caucasian features and a shade of brown skin that was lighter than some, darker than others, but a shade all his own.
"I'm alive and sober," Nate thought, sipping. "I have once again touched briefly the edge of hell and survived. I've bottomed, I've crashed, I've stared at the blurred image of my face and welcomed death. Yet here I am sitting and breathing. Twice in 3 days I have uttered my last words. Maybe it's not my time."
"Mace?"
Welly asked, nodding at the empty cup.
"Sing,"
Nate replied, and handed it to him. 2 steps, and he was gone. Stiff from the plane wreck and shaky from the vodka, Nate pulled himself up and stood unaided in the center of the deck, wobbly and bent at the knees. But he was able to stand, and this alone meant everything. Recovery was nothing but a series of small steps, small victories. String them together with no stumbles and no defeats, and you're treated. Never cured, just treated, or rehabbed, or sanitized for a while. He'd done the puzzle before. Celebrate every little piece. Then the flat bottom of the boat brushed a sandbar, jolting it, and Nate fell hard against the hammock. It flipped him onto the deck, where his head cracked on a wooden plank. He scrambled to his feet and clutched the railing with one hand while rubbing his skull with the other. No blood, just a small knot, just another little wound to the flesh. But the blow woke him, and when his eyes cleared, he moved slowly along the railing to the small, cramped bridge, where Chevy sat on a stool, one hand draped over the wheel. The quick Brazilian smile, then, "How do you feel?"
"Much better," Nate said, almost ashamed.
But shame was an emotion Nate had abandoned years earlier. Addicts know no shame. You disgrace yourself so many times you become immune to it. Welly bounced up the steps with coffee in both hands. He gave one to Nate and the other to Chevy, then took his perch on a narrow bench next to the captain. The sun was beginning to fall behind the distant mountains of Bolivia, and clouds were forming to the north directly in front of them. The air was light and much cooler. Chevy found his T-shirt and put it on. Nate feared another storm, but the river wasn't wide. Surely they could land the damned boat and tie to a tree. They approached a little square house, the first dwelling Nate had seen since Corumbá. There were signs of life. A horse and a cow wash on the line, a canoe near the water. A man with a straw hat, a bona fide pantaneiro, stepped onto the porch and gave them a lazy wave. Past the house, Welly pointed to a spot where thick undergrowth spilled into the river.
"Jacarés," he said.
Chevy looked but seemed not to care. He'd seen a million alligators. Nate had seen only one, from the back of a horse, and as he gazed at the slimy reptiles watching them from the mud, he was struck by how much smaller they appeared from the deck of a boat. He preferred the distance. Something told him, though, that before his journey was over, he would once again get too close for comfort. The John boat trailing behind the Santa Laura would have to be used in their search for Rachel Lane. He and Chevy would navigate small rivers, dodge undergrowth, wade through dark and weedy waters. Surely there would be jacarés and other species of vicious reptiles waiting for lunch. But oddly, Nate didn't care at the moment. So far in Brazil, he'd proven himself quite resistant. It was an adventure, and his guide seemed fearless. Grasping the handrail, he managed the steps down with great care, then shuffled along the narrow walkway past the cabin and the kitchen where Welly had a pot on the propane stove. The diesel roared in the engine room. The last stop was the restroom, a small closet with a toilet, a dirty sink in a corner, and a flimsy shower head swinging back and forth inches above his head. He relieved himself while studying the cord for the shower. He backed away and pulled it. Warm water with a slight brownish tint came down with sufficient force. It was obviously river water, scooped from an unlimited supply and presumably unfiltered. There was a wire basket above the door for a towel and a change of clothes, so he had to strip and somehow straddle the toilet while pulling the shower rope with one hand and bathing with the other. "What the hell?" thought Nate. "There simply wouldn't be many showers." He looked in the pot on the stove and found it filled with rice and black beans and wondered if every meal would be the same. But he didn't really care. Food was not an issue with him. At Walnut Hill, they dried you out while gently starving you. His appetite had shrunk months earlier. He sat on the steps to the bridge, his back to the captain and Welly, and watched the river grow dark. In the dusk, the wildlife prepared itself for the night. Birds flew low over the water, moving from tree to tree, looking for one last minnow or fish for the night. They called to each other as the boat passed, their chants and shrieks rising well above the steady drone of the diesel. Water splashed along the banks as alligators moved about. Perhaps there were snakes in there, too, large anacondas bedding down. But Nate preferred not to think about them. He felt quite safe on the Santa Laura. The breeze was slight and warmer now and blowing at them. The storm had not materialized. Time was racing somewhere else, but in the Pantanal, time was of no consequence. He was slowly adjusting to it. He thought of Rachel Lane. What would the money do to her? No one, regardless of his level of faith and commitment, could remain the same. Would she leave with him and go to the States to tend to her father's estate? She could always return to her Indians. How would she greet the news? How would she react to the sight of an American lawyer who'd tracked her down?
Welly strummed an old guitar, and Jevy added some low and unrefined vocals. Their duet was pleasant, almost soothing, the song of simple men who lived by the day and not by the minute, men who gave little thought to tomorrow and none for what may or may not happen next year. He envied them, at least while they were singing. It was quite a comeback for a man who'd tried to drink himself to death a day earlier. He was enjoying the moment, happy to be alive, looking forward to the rest of his adventure. His past was truly in another world, light years away, in the cold, wet streets of Washington. Nothing good could happen there. He'd proved clearly that he could not stay clean living there, knowing the same people, doing the same work, ignoring the same old habits until he crashed. He would always crash. Welly started a solo that snapped Nate away from his past. It was a slow, mournful ballad that lasted until the river was completely dark. Jevy switched on two small floodlights, one on each side of the bow. The river was easy to navigate. It rose and fell with the seasons, and never attained much depth. The boats were shallow and flat on the bottom, and built to take sandbars that sometimes got in the way. Jevy hit one just after dark, and the Santa Laura stopped moving. He reversed the engine, then thrust it forward, and after 5 minutes of this maneuvering, they were free again. The boat was unsinkable. In a corner of the cabin, not far from the four bunks, Nate ate alone at a table that was bolted to the floor. Welly served him the beans and rice, along with boiled chicken and an orange. He drank cold water from a bottle. A bulb on a light cord swung above his food. The cabin was hot and unventilated. Welly had suggested sleeping in the hammock. Jevy arrived with a navigational map of the Pantanal. He wanted to plot their progress, and so far there had been little. They were indeed inching up the Paraguay, with only a tiny gap between their current position and Corumbá.
"The water is high," Jevy explained. "We'll go much faster on the return."
The return was not something Nate had thought much about.
"No problem," he said. Jevy pointed in various directions and made some more calculations.
"The first Indian village is in this area," he said, pointing to a spot that looked weeks away, given their current pace.
"Guato?"
"Sin, yes. I think we should go there first. If she's not there, then maybe someone knows where she is."
"How long before we get there?"
2, maybe 3 days.
Nate shrugged. Time had stopped. His wristwatch was in his pocket. His collection of hourly, daily, weekly, monthly planners was long forgotten. His trial calendar, the one great inviolate map of his life, had been tucked away in some secretary's drawer. He had cheated death, and so every day now was a gift.
"I have lots of reading," he said.
Jevy carefully refolded the map.
"Are you okay?" he asked.
"I'm fine. I feel good."
There was a lot more Jevy wanted to ask. Nate was not ready for a confessional.
"I'm fine," he said again. "This little trip will be good for me."
He read for an hour at the table under the swaying light until he realized he was soaked with sweat. From his bunk he gathered insect repellent, a flashlight, and a stack of Josh's memos, and he carefully made his way to the bow, then up the steps to the wheelhouse where Welly was in command and Jevy was catching a nap. He sprayed his arms and legs, then crawled into the hammock, squirming and adjusting until his head was properly elevated above his butt. When things were perfectly balanced and the hammock swung gently with the flow of the river, Nate clicked on his flashlight and began reading again.
Chapter 18.
It was a simple hearing, a reading of a will, but the details were crucial. F. Parr Wycliffe had thought of little else during his Christmas holiday. Every seat in his courtroom would be filled, with more spectators packed three deep against the walls. He'd worried so much that the day after Christmas he had walked around his empty courtroom pondering where to seat everyone. And typically the press was out of control. They wanted cameras inside, and he had vehemently refused. They wanted cameras in the hallway, peering in through the small square windows and the doors, and he said no. They wanted preferred seating. Again, no. They wanted interviews with him, and he was stiff-arming them at the moment. The lawyers, too, were showing their asses. Some wanted the entire hearing closed to the world, others wanted it televised for obvious reasons. Some wanted the file sealed, others wanted copies of the will faxed over for their perusal. There were motions for this and that, requests to have seating here and there, concerns about who would be allowed inside the courtroom and who would not. Several of the lawyers went so far as to suggest that they be allowed to open and read the will. It was quite thick, you know, and they might be forced to explain some of the more intricate provisions as they read along. Wycliffe arrived early and met with the extra deputies he'd requested. They followed him, along with his secretary and his law clerk, around the courtroom as he made seat assignments and tested the sound system and counted chairs. He was very concerned with the details. Someone said a television news crew was attempting to set up camp down the hall, and he quickly dispatched a deputy to retake the area. With the courtroom secure and organized, he retired to his office to tend to other matters. Concentration was difficult. Never again would his daily calendar promise such excitement. Quite selfishly, he hoped that the will of Troy Phelan was scandalously controversial, that it stripped money from one ex-family and awarded it to another, or perhaps it screwed all of his crazy children and made someone else rich. A long, nasty will contest would certainly liven up Wycliffe's rather mundane career in probate. He'd be the center of the storm, one that would no doubt rage for years, with $11 billion at stake. He was certain this would happen. Alone, with his door locked, he spent 15 minutes ironing his robe. The first spectator was a reporter who arrived just after 8, and because he was the first, he received the full treatment from the jumpy security detail blocking the double doors to the courtroom. He was greeted gruffly, asked to produce a picture ID and sign a sheet for journalists, got his steno pad inspected as if it were a grenade, then was directed through the metal detector, where two thick guards were obviously disappointed when no sirens erupted as he passed through. He was grateful he did not get strip-searched. Once inside, he was led down the center aisle by yet another uniformed officer to a spot 2 rows from the front. He was relieved to get a seat. The courtroom was empty. The hearing was set for 10, and by 9 a nice crowd had assembled in the foyer outside the courtroom. Security was taking its time with the paperwork and the searches. A line formed down the hall. Some of the lawyers for the Phelan heirs arrived in a rush and became instantly irritated with the delay in getting into the courtroom. Harsh words were exchanged. Threats were made and received by the lawyers and by the deputies. Someone sent for Wycliffe, but he was polishing his boots and didn't want to be disturbed. And, like a bride before the wedding, he didn't want to be seen by the guests. The heirs and the lawyers were given priority, and this eased the tense situation. The courtroom slowly filled. Tables were placed in a U-shape, with the judge's bench at the open end, so that His Honor could look down from his perch and see everyone, lawyers, heirs, spectators. To the left of the bench, in front of the jury box, was a long table where the Phelans were being placed. Troy Jr. was first, with Biff in tow. They were directed to a spot nearest the bench, where they sat and huddled with 3 lawyers from their legal team, while working desperately to appear somber and at the same time ignore everyone else in the courtroom. Biff was furious because the security detail had confiscated her cell phone. She couldn't make real estate calls. Ramble was next. For the occasion, he had neglected his hair, which still bore streaks of lime green and hadn't been washed in 2 weeks. His rings were in full glory, ear, nose, eyebrow. Black leather jacket with no sleeves, temporary tattoos on his skinny arms, ragged jeans, old boots, surly attitude. He caught the attention of the journalists when he walked down the aisle. He was coddled and fussed over every step of the way by Yancey, his aging hippie lawyer, who had somehow managed to hang on to his prized client. Yancey took a quick look at the seating scheme and asked to sit as far away from Troy Jr. as possible. The deputy complied and put them at the end of a temporary table facing the bench. Ramble sank into his chair, green hair hanging over the back of it. The spectators watched him in horror. This thing was about to inherit a $500 million. The potential for mayhem seemed limitless. Gina Phelan Strong was next, with her husband Cody and two of their lawyers. They gauged the distance between Troy Jr. and Ramble, then split the difference and sat as far away from both as possible. Cody was particularly burdened and earnest, and immediately began reviewing some important papers with one of his lawyers. Gina just gawked at Ramble. She couldn't believe they were half-brother and sister. Amber, the stripper, made a grand entrance in a short skirt and low-cut blouse that gave away most of her expensive breasts. The deputy escorting her down the aisle couldn't believe his good fortune. He chatted her up along the way, eyes glued to the edge of her blouse. Rex followed behind in a dark suit, carrying a bulky briefcase as if he had serious work today. Behind him was Hark Geddes, still the noisiest advocate of the bunch. Hark brought with him two of his new associates. His firm was growing by the week. Since Amber and Biff weren't speaking, Rex quickly intervened and pointed to a spot between Ramble and Gina. The tables were filling. The gaps were closing. Before long, some of the Phelans would be sitting close to each other. Ramble's mother, Tyra, brought two young men of about the same age. One had tight jeans and a hairy chest. The other was well-groomed in dark pinstripes. She was sleeping with the gigolo. The lawyer would get his on the back end. Another gap was filled. On the other side of the bar, the courtroom was alive with the hum of gossip and speculation. "No wonder the old man jumped," one reporter said to another as they examined the Phelans. The Phelan grandchildren were forced to sit with the spectators and common folk. They huddled with their small entourages and support groups and giggled nervously as fate was about to swing their way. Libigail Jeter arrived with her husband, Spike, the 320-pound ex-biker, and they waddled down the aisle as out of place as anyone, though they'd seen their share of courtrooms. They followed Wally Bright, their Yellow Pages lawyer. Wally wore a spotted raincoat that dragged the floor, scuffed wingtips, and a polyester tie that was 20 years old, and if the spectators had voted right then, he would have easily won the award for the worst-dressed lawyer. He carried his papers in an expandable file, one that had been used for countless divorces and other matters. For some reason, Bright had never purchased a briefcase. He'd finished 10th in his class in night school. They went straight for the widest gap, and as they were taking their seats, Bright began the noisy process of removing his raincoat. The ragged hem of it brushed against the neck of one of Hark's nameless associates, an earnest young man already bothered by Bright's body odor. "If you don't mind," he said sharply, swinging a backhand toward Bright and missing. The words cracked through the tense and edgy air. Heads jerked around the tables as important documents were instantly ignored. Everybody hated everybody. "Sorry," Bright responded with great sarcasm. Two deputies moved forward to intervene if necessary. But the raincoat found a place under the table without further incident, and Bright finally managed to seat himself, next to Libigail, with Spike sitting on the other side, stroking his beard and staring at Troy Jr. as if he'd love to slap him. Few people in the courtroom expected the brief skirmish to be the last among the Phelans. You die with 11 billion, and people care about your last will and testament, especially if there's a chance that one of the world's great fortunes is about to be fed to the vultures. The tabloids were there, along with the local papers and all the important financial magazines. The three rows Wycliffe had designated for the press were full by 9:30. The journalists had a delightful time watching the Phelans gather in front of them. Three artists worked feverishly. The panorama before them was rich with inspiration. The punk with the green hair received more than his share of sketches. Josh Stafford made his appearance at 9:50. Tip Durbin was with him, along with two other members of the firm and a couple of paralegals to round out the team. Stern and somber-faced, they took seats at their table, a rather spacious one compared to the cramped quarters holding all the Phelans and all their lawyers. Josh placed a single thick file in front of him, and all eyes were immediately upon it. Inside was what appeared to be a document, almost 2 inches thick, and very similar to what old Troy had signed on video just 19 days earlier. They couldn't help staring at it, everyone but Ramble. Virginia law allowed heirs to receive early distributions if the estate was liquid and there was no concern about the payment of debts and taxes. Estimates from the Phelan lawyers ranged from a low of $10 million per heir all the way to Bright's guess of $50 million. Bright, in his entire life, had never seen $50,000. At 10, the deputies locked the doors, and upon some unseen cue, Judge Wycliffe emerged from an opening behind the bench, and the room was silent. He eased into the chair, his crisp robe settling around him, and smiled. "Good morning," he said into the microphone. Everyone smiled back. To his great satisfaction, the room was filled to capacity. A quick deputy count revealed 8 armed and ready. He studied the Phelans. There were no gaps left. Some of their lawyers were practically touching one another. "Are all of the parties present?" he asked. Heads shook from around the tables. "I need to identify everyone," he said, reaching for papers. "The first petition was filed by Rex Phelan." Before the word settled, Hart Geddes was on his feet, clearing his throat. "Your Honor, I'm Hart Geddes," he boomed toward the bench, "and I represent Mr. Rex Phelan." "Thank you. You may keep your seat." He went around the tables, methodically taking names of the heirs and the lawyers. All the lawyers. The reporters scribbled them as fast as the judge. 6 heirs in all, 3 ex-wives. Everyone was present. 22 lawyers, Wycliffe mumbled to himself. "Do you have the will, Mr. Stafford?" he asked. Josh stood, holding a different file.
"I do."
"Would you please take the witness stand?" Josh made his way around the tables and passed the court reporter to the witness stand, where he raised his right hand and swore to tell the truth. "You represented Troy Phelan?" Wycliffe asked.
"I did for a number of years."
"Did you prepare a will for him?"
"I prepared several."
"Did you prepare his last will?" There was a pause, and as it grew longer, the Phelans inched closer.
"No, I did not," Josh said slowly, looking at the vultures.
The words were soft, but they cut through the air like thunder. The Phelan lawyers reacted much more quickly than the Phelan heirs, several of whom weren't sure what to make of it. But it was serious and unexpected. Another layer of tension settled around the tables. The courtroom grew even quieter. "Who prepared his last will and testament?" Wycliffe asked, like a bad actor reading a script.
"Mr. Phelan himself."
It wasn't so. They had seen the old man sit at the table with lawyers all around him and the 3 shrinks, Zadel, Flo, and Thetian, directly across the table. He'd been declared sane on the spot, and seconds later had taken a thick will prepared by Stafford and one of his associates, declared it to be his, and signed it. There was no dispute about this.
"Oh, my God," Hart Geddes said, under his breath but loud enough for everyone to hear.
"When did he sign it?" Wycliffe asked. moments before he jumped to his death.
Is it handwritten?
It is.
Did he sign it in your presence?
He did. There were other witnesses. The signing was also videotaped.
Please hand me the will.
Josh deliberately withdrew a single envelope from the file and passed it up to His Honor. It looked awfully small.
There was no way it contained enough language to convey to the Phelans what was rightfully theirs.
What the hell is this?
Troy Jr. hissed at the nearest lawyer, but the lawyer couldn't respond. The envelope held only one sheet of yellow paper. Wycliffe removed it slowly for all to see, unfolded it carefully, then studied it for a moment. Panic seized the Phelans, but there was nothing they could do. Had the old man screwed them one last time? Was the money slipping away? Maybe he had changed his mind and given them even more. Around the tables, they nudged and elbowed their lawyers, all of whom were remarkably quiet. Wycliffe cleared his throat and leaned a bit closer to the microphone.
I'm holding here a one-page document purporting to be a will handwritten by Troy Phelan. I will read it straight through. The Last Testament of Troy L. Phelan. I, Troy L. Phelan, being of sound and disposing mind and memory, do hereby expressly revoke all former wills and codicils executed by me, and dispose of my estate as follows. To my children, Troy Phelan Jr., Rex Phelan, Libigail Jeter, Mary Ross Jackman, Gina Strong, and Ramble Phelan, I give each a sum of money necessary to pay off all the debts of each as of today. Any debts incurred after today will not be covered by this gift. If any of these children attempt to contest this will, then this gift shall be nullified as to that child.
Even Ramble heard the words and understood them. Gina and Cody started crying softly. Rex leaned forward, elbows on the table, face buried in his hands, his mind numb. Libigail looked past Bright to Spike and said, "That son of a bitch!" Spike concurred. Mary Ross covered her eyes as her lawyer rubbed her knee. Her husband rubbed the other one. Only Troy Jr. managed a poker face, but not for much longer. There was more damage yet to come. Wycliffe wasn't finished.
To my ex-wives, Lillian, Janie, and Tyra, I give nothing. They were adequately provided for in the divorces.
At that moment, Lillian, Janie, and Tyra were wondering what the hell they were doing in the courtroom. Had they really expected to receive more cash from a man they hated? They felt the stares and tried to hide among their lawyers. The reporters and journalists were downright giddy. They wanted to take notes, but they were afraid of missing a single word. Some couldn't help but grin.
The remainder of my estate I give to my daughter, Rachel Lane, born on November 2, 1954, at Catholic Hospital in New Orleans, Louisiana, to a woman named Evelyn Cunningham, now deceased.
Wycliffe paused, though not for dramatic effect. With only two small paragraphs left, the damage was done. The $11 billion had been given to an illegitimate heir he'd not read about. The Phelans sitting before him had been stripped. He couldn't help but look at them.
I appoint my trusted lawyer, Joshua Stafford, as executor of this will, and grant unto him broad discretionary powers in its administration.
For the moment they had forgotten about Josh, but there he sat, in the box, like the innocent witness of a car wreck, and they glared at him with as much hatred as possible. How much had he known? Was he a conspirator? No doubt he could have done something to prevent this.
Josh fought to keep a straight face.
This document is intended to be a holographic will. Every word has been written by my hand, and I hereby sign it.
Wycliffe lowered it and said, "The testament was signed by Troy L. Phelan at 3 p.m. on December 9, 1996.
He laid it down and looked around the courtroom, the epicenter. The quake was ending, and now it was time for the aftershocks. The Phelans sat low in their seats, some rubbing eyes and foreheads, others staring wildly at the walls. For the moment, all 22 lawyers were incapable of speech. The shocks rippled through the rows of spectators, where, oddly, a few smiles could be seen. Ah, it was the media, suddenly anxious to race from the room and start reporting. Amber sobbed loudly, then caught herself. She'd met Troy only once, and he'd made a crude advance. Her grief was not for the loss of a loved one. Gina cried quietly, as did Mary Ross. Libigail and Spike chose to curse instead.
"Don't worry," Bright said, waving them off as if he could remedy this injustice in a matter of days.
Biff glared at Troy Jr., and the seeds of a divorce were planted. Since the suicide, he'd been especially arrogant and condescending to her. She'd tolerated it for obvious reasons, but no longer. She relished the first fight, one that would no doubt begin just a few feet outside the courtroom doors. Other seeds were planted. For the thick-skinned lawyers, the surprise was received, absorbed, then shaken off, as instinctively as a duck shakes off water. They were about to get rich. Their clients were heavily in debt, with no relief in sight. They had no choice but to contest the will. Litigation would rage for years.
"When do you anticipate probating the will?" Wycliffe asked Josh.
"Within a week."
"Very well, you may step down." Josh returned to his seat, triumphant, as the lawyers began shuffling papers and pretending everything was fine.
"We are adjourned."
Chapter 19 There were three fights in the hallway after adjournment. Fortunately, none involved Phelans fighting Phelans. Those would come later. A mob of reporters waited outside the courtroom doors as the Phelans were consoled inside by their lawyers. Troy Jr. was the first to exit, and he was immediately surrounded by a pack of wolves, several with microphones in the attack position. He was hung over to begin with, and now that he was a half a billion dollars poorer, he was in no mood to talk about his father.
"Are you surprised?" some idiot asked from behind a microphone.
"Damned right," he said, trying to walk through the group.
"Who is Rachel Lane?" asked another.
"I guess she's my sister," he snapped.
A skinny little boy with stupid eyes and a bad complexion stopped directly in front of him, thrust a tape recorder in his face, and asked, "How many illegitimate children did your father have?" Troy Jr. instinctively shoved the tape recorder back at him. It landed sharply just above his nose, and as he fell back, Troy Jr. launched a wild left hook that popped him in the ear and knocked him down. In the commotion, a deputy pushed Troy Jr. in another direction, and they made a quick escape. Ramble spit on another reporter, who had to be restrained by a colleague who reminded him the kid was underage. The third skirmish happened when Libigail and Spike lumbered out of the courtroom behind Wally Bright.
"No comment," Bright yelled at the horde closing ranks around them. "No comment, please get out of the way."
Libigail, who was crying, tripped over a TV cable and tumbled into a reporter, who also fell. There were shouts and curses, and as the reporter was on all fours and getting to his feet, Spike kicked him in the ribs. He squealed and fell flat again, and as he was thrashing about trying to get up, his foot caught the edge of Libigail's dress, and she slapped him for good measure. Spike was about to slaughter him when a deputy intervened. Deputies broke up each fight, always siding with the Phelans over the reporters. They helped rush the beleaguered heirs and their lawyers down the stairs, through the lobby, and out of the building. Lawyer Grit, who represented Mary Ross Phelan Jackman, was overcome by the sight of so many reporters. The First Amendment seized him, or at least his own rudimentary understanding of it, and he felt compelled to speak freely. With his arm around his distraught client, he grimly offered their reaction to the surprise will. It was obviously the work of a demented man.
How else could you explain the passing of such a great fortune to an unknown heir? His client adored her father, loved him deeply, worshipped him, and as Grit babbled on and on about the incredible love between father and daughter, Mary Ross finally took the hint and began crying. Grit himself appeared on the verge of tears. Yes, they would fight. They would battle this grave injustice to the U.S. Supreme Court. Why? Because this was not the work of the Troy Phelan they knew. Bless his heart. He loved his children, and they loved him. Theirs was an incredible bond forged through tragedy and hardship. They would fight because their beloved father was not himself when he scribbled this ghastly document. Josh Stafford was in no hurry to leave. He spoke quietly to Hart Geddes and some of the attorneys from the other tables. He promised to send them copies of the hideous will. Things were initially cordial, but hostilities were growing by the minute. A reporter he knew from the Post was waiting in the hall, and Josh spent 10 minutes with him while saying nothing. Of particular interest was Rachel Lane, her history and whereabouts. There were lots of questions, but Josh had no answers. Surely Nate would find her before anyone else. The story grew. It shot from the courthouse on the waves of the latest telecommunications gadgets and high-tech hardware. The reporters scrambled with cell phones and laptops and pagers, talking without thinking. The major wires began running the news 20 minutes after adjournment, and an hour later the first round-the-clock news gabathon broke into its running series of repetitive stories to go live to a reporter in front of a camera outside the courthouse. "Stunning news here," she began, and then told the story, getting most of it right. Seated in the rear of the courtroom was Pat Solomon, the last person selected by Troy to run the Phelan Group. He'd been CEO for 6 years, 6 very uneventful and very profitable years. He left the courthouse without being recognized by any reporter. As he rode away in the back of his limo, Solomon attempted to analyze Troy's last bombshell. He was not shocked by it. After working for Troy for 20 years, nothing surprised him. The reaction of his idiot children and their lawyers was comforting. Solomon had once been assigned the impossible task of finding within the company a job that Troy Jr. could perform without causing a dip in quarterly profits. It had been a nightmare.